It's Central Time. I'm Cynthia Schuster, filling in for Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we'll find out what it's like to compete in the longest and largest cross-country ski race in North America, the Birkebeiner. It takes place this weekend in Wisconsin.
First, a recent study claims to have new evidence that indicates tighter gun control laws can reduce gun violence.
The study looked at the data and statistics after the repeal of a 2007 law in Missouri, and the conclusions make a strong case that there's a correlation between weak firearm laws and increased gun violence.
Daniel Webster joins us now. He's one of the study's lead authors and the director of the Johns Hopkins Center for Gun Policy and Research. Daniel, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Sure. Well, this study looked at the repeal of a 2007 gun control law in Missouri. What did that law say?
Well, the law was repealed in 2007, and prior to that, it had been in place since 1921. It was a law that required anyone who wanted to purchase a handgun to first apply for a permit through the local sheriff's office, where they would carefully do a background check, and then issue a permit that would be good for a 30-day period in which someone could purchase a handgun. Importantly, this permit was required not only when someone wanted to buy a handgun from a licensed gun dealer, but also anyone who was selling a handgun, including unlicensed private sellers.
Do we know why it was repealed?
Well, honestly, I don't know a lot about the whole political process in their decision to repeal, but, you know, many states, there are individuals and organizations that do not like gun control, and Missouri had actually a fairly robust system for regulating handguns prior to the repeal in 2007.
What did you observe? What happened after the law was repealed?
It was really quite striking. There was an immediate increase in firearm-related homicides in the state in the first full 3 years after the law was repealed. Firearm homicide rates increased by 25%. Now, what was even more striking is that this was against the national trend. At that same time period, the rest of the United States, firearm homicide rates were going down by more than 5%. And even if you looked regional, if you looked at all the states that surround and border Missouri collectively, they also were experiencing declines in firearm homicides. So it was a very large and sudden increase coincident with the repeal of this law that really was unique to Missouri.
Explain for a bit why your evidence, or whether your evidence, seems to indicate that the increase in the murder rate is a direct result of the repeal of these laws and not some other factor, or even just a coincidence.
Sure. Well, of course, policy researchers don't have the ability or luxury to do randomized experiments like other scientists. So what we do is we do very careful analysis at changes in response to public policy, and we try to rule out alternative explanations. So if the law was causing this change that we observed, you would expect it only to affect homicides involving guns. That's precisely what we found. You would also expect that it would be an increase that was experienced throughout the state rather than perhaps a sudden big increase in one city, say St. Louis, if a gang war broke out or some failing of local law enforcement. But we saw this sudden increase throughout the state. And then we looked at other potential explanations. Could it be unemployment, changes in poverty rates, changes in policing levels, incarceration rates, or other changes in public policies? So we gathered data on all of those factors and statistically controlled for those factors. And there was still a very, very strong, highly statistically significant effect of the law that showed roughly 23% of the increase in firearm homicides attributable to the change in the policy.
Now, Missouri had also enacted a Stand Your Ground law the same year that these permit requirements were repealed. How did that throw a wrinkle in your research?
Yes, I'm glad you pointed that out. So there were many states that were passing laws of this type during the study period of 1999 through 2012. And so we wanted to statistically control for those types of changes, including Missouri. So in essence, what you do is you account for the average effect that's going on all the states that are adopting these laws. And we still found this, again, very large and statistically significant increase. Again, we, as policy researchers, we can't manipulate these factors. We just statistically control for them.
Mm-hmm. We've been talking a lot about Missouri, and in fact, much of the news coming out about your study looks at that. But did you look at other states in the country, and what states have similar laws, and what have their statistics shown you?
Sure. So our study included data from all 50 states. So we were looking at how these trends were changing across all 50 states and wanted to see whether the change in Missouri was indeed unique at that time, and it clearly was. We also were examining other public policies and their impacts on homicides as well. Our prior research, we've been doing research on these policies for a long time, and we published two prior studies that looked at these laws as well as other laws like other ways to regulate private transactions and regulate firearm dealers. And we found consistently that the strongest effect for reducing the diversion of guns to criminals is through these permit-to-purchase licensing laws that require prospective purchasers to apply in person to a law enforcement agency.
What do you hope that policymakers take away from the study, if anything?
Well, I think it demonstrates the power of reasonable gun regulations to save lives. This is a type of policy that really does not take away anyone's gun who is a law-abiding citizen. Really has minimal effect on one's ability to purchase guns. It simply is does something that generally there's agreement across the board, whether you're a gun owner or not, which is we want to keep guns out of the wrong hands. And so Missouri was doing this quite effectively for a number of years. And when they decided to repeal that law, they did criminals a favor. They made it easier for them to get guns, and the result was more deaths.
Well, Daniel, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Daniel Webster is the director of the Johns Hopkins Center for Gun Policy and Research.
In Norway and Wisconsin, the race goes on. From Hayward to Telemark, to sing a song about the best in the world, about you and me, doing the Burke upon her rag.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Cynthia Schuster.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Festivities are getting underway today in northern Wisconsin as we approach the 41st annual Birkebeiner race. And that's the famous Birkebeiner rag you're hearing in the background.
The Birkie's a Wisconsin tradition, and not to mention the largest and longest cross-country ski race in North America. The 54-kilometer race, as well as some shorter events, bring about 10,000 skiers to the state each year. In today's edition of Curious Wisconsin, we find out what it's like to train for and compete in the American Birkebeiner.
Joining us now is Mike Ivey by day. He's a reporter at the Capital Times in Madison, but in his free time, he's an avid cross-country skier who's competed in numerous Birkebeiners. He'll be doing it again in just a couple of days. Mike, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me, guys.
Well, Mike, you are a total Birkebeiner nut. You're doing your 26th Birkebeiner this weekend, so I guess we got to ask you, why do you keep going back and doing it? What do you love about it?
It's a bad habit I can't shake. I started signing up for it and doing it, and then I think they kind of rope you in, because after you do 20 Berkeys, you get a special purple bib to wear during the race. And now when you hit 30, they give you a gold bib. So they keep throwing these milestones out there along the way.
So it's a purple bib.
I'm a member of the Purple Bib Club. They call it the Birch Leggings Club. Birkebeiner actually is a Norwegian term for birch bark that goes over the top of your boots and pants. And according to Norwegian lore, 600 years ago, warriors dressed in that type of garb rescued the baby prince during the Norwegian Civil War, and that's sort of what started the whole tradition of the Birkebeiner.
Tell us a little bit about the race. How long is it, and how challenging for you?
Well, there's a couple of different events. They have a 54-kilometer classic style where you go with your ski side by side, and then they have the 50-kilometer freestyle race, which is more of a skating technique. If you watch some of the skiing on the Olympics on TV or the biathletes, you'll see those guys sort of look like they're almost skating on their skis. And it's a hard race to do because it's so hilly, is one of the things about the Birke course, up and down, so it can be a long, grueling day out there. I'll tell you what everybody's talking about right now is this giant winter storm that seems to be bearing right down on Hayward, where the race finishes, and I would assume most of the Birke skiers are kind of glued to their computers getting the recent weather update, but they're predicting anywhere from 10 to 15 inches of snow tonight and into tomorrow morning. So that's going to make it difficult to get the course packed down. And
so that's bad news for the skiers, a lot of snow?
Because it really slows things down when the snow's too deep. I mean, I think a lot of skiers would rather have it fast with the snow packed down. I like it hard and icy and fast. I mean, I've been doing it a long time. But I think it's going to be a long slug. Mashed potatoes, if you can imagine skiing through mashed potatoes, because when that many skiers go over the course, they really tend to churn it up.
How do you train for a race like this?
Well, I think for a lot of people, it becomes a real part of their lifestyle. They maybe bicycle in the summer or do runs or people paddle. And I think the Birke tries to sell it as a whole year-round lifestyle thing that you're not really, you got that Birke out there looming in the future at some point. So it's a way to keep you going and keep outside. I mean, some people are really super serious about it and go to clinics and kind of devote a good part of their life to having a great time. And I think back before I had kids and was a younger guy, I was probably a little more gung-ho about it. Now I'm, I try and get out when I can and just enjoy really being out there with your friends. It's sort of like a family reunion in a way. I run into people I only see once a year, and I'll see them at the Birke, and they have moved to California or to Washington D.C. or wherever, and then I'll run into them at the finish area. It's one of Wisconsin's really great traditions, and I think one reason that people do enjoy the quality of life we have here.
Well, as someone who's never skied in a race, let alone the Birkebeiner, I've done some cross-country skiing, but I'm curious because I gather there's something like upwards of 1,000 skiers who do this. What is it like?
10,000 skiers.
10,000 skiers. Okay. So what is it like when you're on the trail, you're skiing from Hayward to the Telemark Lodge and Cable, which I gather is closed now, but that's where you're skiing.
It goes the other way. It starts at Telemark and finishes on downtown Hayward. They cover the main street with snow. But what it's like is cross-country skiing, most people think of as sort of a solitary thing. You're out in the woods by yourself. The Birke is the complete opposite. You're never by yourself.
So are you chit-chatting along the way and exchanging bits of gossip, or are you just focused in?
Well, I would say the guys up in the front are probably breathing too hard to do much chit-chatting. But as you as people sort of spread out as you do it more, I think there's quite a bit of chit-chatting. And then there's rest stops along the way. So there's 7 or 8 stops with warming fires, and they provide hot drinks for the skiers and bananas and donuts and stuff like that to, sort of keep your energy up. And there's a fair amount of camaraderie out there. I would say that new people are trying to, nobody's trying to really knock each other down too much. I mean, there's some guys that get maybe a little too excited, but for the most part, I think people realize it's a fun thing, and it's, you know, they're all out there together kind of testing ourselves and try and make sure everybody has a good time.
Would you say that a good number of these people that are competing alongside of you are amateur athletes, or are they just out for, they just enjoy the cross-country skiing?
It really depends where you start, because they have these different waves depending on your previous year's finish time. So, like, the real fast people end up in the front, wave one, or the elite wave for almost, you know, Olympic-caliber type people. And then as you go farther back, people are slower and slower. So they, you know, they probably are a little more, you know, it's not quite as competitive in the back. So it really, it's something that everybody can do. I think a lot of people, maybe that's the only ski race they do all year. Then whereas you get the guys up in the front, they might be doing a ski race every weekend. They're sort of on the circuit. So it really runs the gamut. Plus they have a shorter race that's only 23 kilometers called the Kortaløpet. I think that's Norwegian for short race. And they even have a 12-kilometer race. And then the few days leading up to the event, they have other stuff like a short kids race and some other events, that kind of fun thing. So there's really something for everybody if you're not up for doing the whole 50-kilometer thing.
Now, you talked a little bit about the history of the Birkebeiner. It took originally, the name came from a Norwegian event where a couple of skiers were trying to smuggle a prince to a different city.
Exactly.
In Norway through some mountains. And I gather that in Norway, some of the skiers will still carry a pack on their back to symbolize
this
18-month-old. Do people do that up in Hayward?
I've never seen. Actually, if they're going to go to Norway and do it, Norway still has their own Birkebeiner, and to do that, you need to carry a pack that simulates the weight of the prince. That's just sort of how crazy that one is. Hmm. The American Birkebeiner was actually started by the founder of Telemark Resort, the late Tony Wise, as sort of a tourism draw. And if you remember back to in the 70s, skiing sort of was really taking off here as part of the running fitness boom. So he said, hey, here's a way to get the people to come up to my resort. So he started this race. And it used to go the other way from Hayward to Telemark and ended at his resort. And he said, I'll drum up a bunch of business. And then it really took off. And it's become the largest, like you were saying, the largest cross-country ski race in North America.
How long does it take you to actually finish this 54-kilometer journey?
Boy, back when I was a younger guy, I think my fastest time was maybe 2 hours, 35 minutes. And then, probably, you know, I've been getting slower as I get older. So I'm hoping this year with all that slow snow, I think around 4 hours it'll probably take me to do it. But the winter, I think the record time is right around 2 hours. So, and then some people take, I think you can take up to 8 hours. They'll kick you out if you're too slow. If you get to the end, they'll say, not, you haven't hit the time limit. But people go, what's fun is at the end, people in Hayward are all standing out. You know, it's like a huge party on Main Street, cheering everybody as they come in. And skiers keep streaming in, I mean, right up till 4 or 5 in the afternoon.
And what do you do when you get to the finish line typically? Do you fall down or do you just have a beer and a steak or something?
Some fall down, but usually the first thing you want to do is take off soggy ski socks and change your clothes. And then they have a giant tent set up with food available and everything. And then a lot of people sort of end up filtering down to the taverns that are on both sides of the street in Hayward, and it becomes a pretty a giant party. I think people in Hayward, it's their single largest tourism day of the year is Birkie Saturday. So it's a huge tourism event for northern Wisconsin, not just Hayward, but all the little motels, and people, you know, stay, you know, hopefully within an hour or so they get to the race start. Giant traffic jam that day, too. It's just going to be, I don't know what it's going to be like with all the snow they're predicting, if they're going to get all the roads open and everything. Fortunately, the snow's coming on Thursday and not Friday.
So you got a day to clear out?
I think so.
What's your best advice that you can offer to cross-country skiers who might be considering the race?
Don't go out too hard. Take it easy. I always say, if you're sweating, you're going too hard. So that's my attitude about it. So I've learned it's a lot more fun to take your time and stop at the aid stations and everything. And I would say get in some, you know, you want to get in some hills, because that's the main thing at the Birkie is the hills. The ups are tough, but as you get to the back, so many people have gone down, they sort of start to snow plow the snow away, and you end up with these giant troughs, like two or three skiers wide across the hills. And it's almost kind of like going down a snow tubing chute, you know, and you've got to watch for people falling in front of you. I remember when I did my first Berkey, I had to start way in the back. I must have fallen 15 times or so. And I remember one time falling and trying to ski over one of those humps. And
wow,
crashing.
It sounds like an adventure. But, Mike, we're going to have to leave it there. Thanks for being with us and good luck.
Thanks.
Mike Ivey is a reporter at the Capital Times. He'll be competing in his 26th Birkebeiner this weekend. When you're at the grocery store, in the meat aisle, it looks like you've got plenty of choices. But according to our next guest, you probably have fewer choices than what you think. He says America's meat industry is taken over by a handful of corporations, including the giant of the industry, Tyson.
Because of that control, Tyson can drive up prices while pushing their farmers to the edge of bankruptcy, according to our guest. He says America's meat industry is now an oligarchy that controls most of the food we eat, and it's completely rigged against us.
Joining us now is Christopher Leonard. He's a fellow with the New America Foundation and former national agribusiness reporter for the Associated Press. His new book is called The Meat Racket, The Secret Takeover of America's Food Business. Christopher, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, you call the meat industry in America today the biggest takeover in American business that you've never heard of. Why has the story slipped under the radar for so long?
Well, I think there are a few reasons, but maybe one of the most important ones is that the companies at the center of this book, like Tyson Foods or Smithfield Foods, are really anchored out in rural communities in the Midwest, especially in Southeast, that really don't get visited by the national press a lot. I've been a business reporter for over 10 years, and I can tell you that most of the focus of the business press is on Wall Street and the stock market and all of this. And some really fundamental and really important changes in the meat industry have gone largely unnoticed because they've happened so far away from the consumer's view.
But you, when you visited some of these towns, I guess you could call them kind of Tyson towns, at least the way you paint them, that the Tyson company sort of props up the entire town and all of the people who live and work there. Can you talk about one of them?
Absolutely. This book really started for me in 2004. I was a business reporter starting to write about the industrial meat system, and I went down to this little town called Waldron, Arkansas. And it is exactly what you described. I would call it a Tyson Foods town. There's an enormous Tyson Foods poultry complex on the north side of town, just a tremendous industrial facility that covers many acres. And what's interesting about it is that the way the modern meat system works today, this meat facility that Tyson owns has incorporated into it all of the businesses that used to be independently owned businesses on downtown Main Street. The Tyson plant will have a large slaughterhouse. It will have a feed mill. It will have a hatchery. It has its own trucking line to take birds out to far-flung farms around the city. So the Tyson plant was really the economic pillar of this town. But what struck me the most was just how much power Tyson had in this area. I had gone there to write about chicken farmers that were having some really serious problems on these large industrial chicken farms, and it just struck me how truly powerless these farmers were. I'm sure you've interviewed farmers before. I mean, they're typically a very entrepreneurial, independent, strong-willed lot, but these people I met outside Waldron, Arkansas were literally afraid to talk about this company, even in the safety of their own living room. Neighbors were afraid that their neighbors would find out that they'd been speaking with a reporter. And this power structure really struck me, and it's what set me off the path of investigating this company and how the modern meat industry really works.
I want to answer the question of why Tyson matters so much. And part of the answer to that is just how pervasive they seem to be in the food industry in the entire country. Can you paint a picture of how wide Tyson's reach is, where their products show up?
Absolutely. And that is a key reason why this company is so important. First of all, Tyson is not a chicken company. It's the biggest producer and one of the biggest in all three major meats. It makes chicken, beef, and pork. And basically, it makes 1 out of 5 pounds of all the meat consumed in the United States. You can walk through the meat aisle of a modern grocery store and just see a rainbow of product names. For different, I mean, everything from pepperoni to chicken pot pie to the rotisserie chicken in the case that's unlabeled. But Tyson Foods makes all of these. And it's the same story for other companies like Smithfield or Cargill. we saw a massive wave of consolidation happen in the 1970s, 80s, and 90s, so that all these independent companies have been bought up by the big four, and now all these separate brand names really can all be traced back to just four companies, which narrows consumers' choice. But I'd also like to say Tyson is so important, not just because of its size and scale and its reach across the market, but because Tyson really pioneered the modern method of meat production, the industrial, very tightly integrated form of meat production. Tyson was on the forefront of it and has been driving some of these changes in the meat business.
Is that another word for factory farming?
Yes, it is. Chickens were the first animals to be factory farmed. I call them the industrial animal. They were sort of the perfect animal to be raised along an assembly line, if you will. I mean, literally, egg-laying hens drop their eggs onto a conveyor belt. The eggs are sent to a giant hatchery where the eggs are agitated on trays, and then the chicks are sent out to farms to be raised. It is like a factory system. But a key element of this, again, is the integration, the fact that you've got one company controlling all the aspects of production. That was a critical part of this formula.
So part of the problem, as you painted in the book, is that because there's so little diversity in meat suppliers in the country, the business practice that Tyson uses go on to become the industry standard. And, for instance, you talk about how Tyson used an antibiotic to increase, or maybe it was an antibiotic, a drug to increase growth in an animal, and that became the norm. Everyone had to do it to keep up.
Yes. And it was a pretty amazing story. It was actually a growth drug called Zilmax that was originally developed for asthma in humans. And somebody figured out that if you fed this drug to cattle, it would make them swell up with muscle. I mean, really pack the pounds on. But it was also found through several studies that it created steaks that were of a lower quality. Well, the advantage to using a drug like Zilmax for a big meat packer like Tyson is that you get more pounds of meat for every cow that goes in the front door of that slaughterhouse. So Tyson began quietly encouraging its contract feedlot owners to use Zilmax. Now, I'd like to pause there for a second. We're talking about the chicken model of raising meat being applied now to hog production and even cattle production. This sort of model, again, where a company controls the aspects of production and farmers raise animals under contract, Tyson has built up a network of feedlots that it operates, it does business with under contract, if you will. The cattle are never sold on an open market. They're given to Tyson under contract. And because there's that kind of arrangement, Tyson could quickly spread the use of this drug Zilmax, which is exactly what happened. And it beefed up its cattle, and then other big meat packers like Cargill were pressured into doing the same thing. I mean, Cargill publicly was saying, we don't want to use this drug Zilmax because it creates lower quality steak and consumers are going to turn away from beef. But there was so much pressure because Tyson was using this that the other companies fell in line. Now, eventually, really grave concerns about animal welfare started coming up last year about Zilmax and the cattle that were fed Zilmax, and Tyson canceled its use of that drug, and other companies followed suit quickly. But I just think it was very telling that this sort of obscure and controversial drug became the industry standard for raising cattle quietly and quickly because the consolidation has happened so massively in this business.
I know you're looking at the big picture here with Tyson, but I want to stop and tell another story from your book. In terms of quality control and health of the animals and people who subsequently eat their meat, you tell a story about a woman who's raising chickens for Tyson, and they contract some kind of mysterious illness, which is sort of horrifyingly described in your book. And it seems as though lots of other farmers have chickens with this issue. And the Tyson people show up in sort of blue hazmat suits. Can you tell that story and what it might imply about safety in food?
Absolutely. When I mentioned earlier that I went down to this town of Waldron, Arkansas, that was exactly the story I was sent there to cover. These farmers, incidentally, these people that own factory farms, like the woman you just mentioned, Kenita Yandell, one of the sources for that chapter of the book, here's how it works. A farmer like that will borrow maybe hundreds of thousands or even millions of dollars to build a large industrial complex of modern-day chicken houses. And then they sign a contract with Tyson Foods. And Tyson Foods will then deliver birds to the farm, deliver feed to the farm, send field techs to the farm. And the farmer basically raises the birds for Tyson, and Tyson comes and picks them up when it's time for slaughter. Farmer never owns the most important asset on the farm. They never own the chicken itself. That can be a very problematic situation, as we can see with Jerry and Kennedy Yandell. In 2003, the Yandells and other farmers around Waldron started getting these shipments of birds that were obviously profoundly sick. They had some kind of horrible disease. They started dying the instant they were delivered. I mean, I don't want to gross out your listeners, but the birds were basically like falling apart while they were still alive. And this poor couple, Jerry and Kenita Yandell, couldn't get answers from Tyson Foods. They were saying, what is the matter with these birds? What's going wrong? And they never got a straight answer out of the company. And this couple, who had worked for over 25 years to build their family chicken farm, they were driven out of business in a matter of just a few months because they got three consecutive flocks of birds with this disease, and the birds were wiped out, so the farmers lost money, but they still had to pay these massive mortgage payments on their farms. And it was remarkable to me that these farmers are kept so close to the edge of bankruptcy that it only took three bad flocks of birds to destroy this family's farm. And, you know, Jerry and Kenita are not some isolated case. They're not the people who got the one bad apple out of a very large bunch of good apples. They are absolutely indicative of cases you see in chicken farmers around the country. The evidence that this is widespread is found in courthouses throughout rural America, enforcement actions by the USDA, newspaper stories everywhere.
We're talking right now with Christopher Leonard, who says the meat industry has been taken over by a handful of corporations. We've been talking about one of the biggest, Tyson Foods. And you can join the conversation at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Have business practices in the meat industry put you off from eating meat? Or do you think this is the cost of having affordable meat on the table? You can reach us at 1-800-642-1234, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. We're talking with Christopher Leonard. He's the author of The Meat Racket, and you can join the conversation at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Wondering what you think about the way meat has been consolidated, the production of meat in America, and whether you think it's worth it to have affordable meat on people's tables. Our number, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@WPR.org. And I want to ask you that question about what Tyson is doing. They have consolidated, and they are one of the food giants in America. But presumably, part of what they're doing is delivering what consumers want, and this is a variety of affordable products that people can fit into their budget. What's wrong with that?
Well, I think that was the case for many years, but is no longer the case. And that's not the conclusion that I thought would be the case when I started reporting the book, but all the evidence supports it. This is a really old situation in economics. When too few companies get too much control over a market, they do a very simple thing. They depress what they pay for goods. In Tyson's case, it depresses what it pays farmers to raise meat. And then they turn around and they can manipulate the market in a way that raises the prices they can charge for a product. It keeps prices higher for consumers. Now, when we industrialized the meat system in the 60s, 70s, and 80s, it made meat cheaper. We got great efficiencies of scale. The system was really streamlined. There were lots of savings that happened, and you saw the cost of meat go down. But something really interesting started to happen in the late 1990s. That cost curve flattened out, and now it's starting to rise, and even rise sharply. I'm sure all of your listeners can relate to the fact that meat has been getting more expensive since about 2007. For some periods, it's been getting sharply more expensive with double-digit price increases. And that points to a fundamental problem of consolidation. When you let, again, too few companies get control of the market, they will tend to exercise the market power they have to raise prices. So This is exactly what we're seeing with these giant meat companies, and I will just give one example. Tyson Foods today, a single company, controls about 22% of the entire national chicken market. That's unprecedented in U.S. history. What Tyson can do and what it has done, and they've said this on the record, it's all in the book, they cut back on production, they cut back supplies when prices get low. That keeps production off the market and makes prices rise again. Poultry companies back in the 80s didn't have enough market power to do this, but doing it has become central to Tyson Foods' playbook today, and it's also central to the playbook of Tyson's one big competitor, Pilgrim's Pride. Together, Tyson's and Pilgrim's Pride control over 40% of the U.S. chicken market, or right at 40% of the national chicken market. So if just two companies decide to cut supply, as they often do, then it can raise the price of chicken for consumers, and that's exactly what's been happening over the last few years.
I want to get our callers in on this. Let's go to Sandy, who's joining us in Algoma. Hi, Sandy.
Hi. Hey, you know what? We really, up in Kewaunee County here, we kind of live in the middle of this situation that this gentleman's talking about. We have lots of these concentrated animal feeding operations up here, and they're making a mess of things. So we have learned the hard way about the serious cost that's affiliated with growing animals in lots of animals in a small amount of space. As a result, a lot of us have learned things that we would never have believed, that these animals are given to eat, that the way that they're treated. And I know that personally, we no longer buy any store-bought meat. We buy it from our neighbors who we know how the animal is grown, how it's treated, and how it's butchered. And the majority of the people that I now know in this area, they're the same way.
Okay, thank you so much for calling, Sandy. Does Sandy represent, do you think, a tipping of the consumer tide where people want to be more sort of up close and personal with the meat they're buying?
Well, that definitely is happening. And there is a lot more of this. It's kind of called maybe the locavore movement, if you want to use a catchphrase. But I hear it all the time. More and more people are doing exactly what Sandy's doing and buying meat from these entrepreneurial farmers who will sell maybe a quarter of a cow, if you will, at a time, or a batch of chickens at a time. And it's an exciting market. And it's a very good thing for rural entrepreneurs who want to get into this business and raise animals that way. I do kind of want to point out that it is today a small part of the market, that the industrial system delivers over 90% of the meat to U.S. citizens. So it's really important that we take a hard look at this system and how it works and how much consolidation we want to allow, instead of maybe just hoping that, you know, consumers will be able to steer their money toward local producers.
Let's go to another phone call now. Scott joins us in Chippewa Falls. Hi, Scott.
Hello. How you doing?
Okay.
Very interesting. I actually do free-range chickens. Every year we run, I have a system where we run them in grass and stuff. And the problem I'm having is access to certified or state-inspected processors. I could sell multiple times more. It's just a matter of, I have to haul them 40-some miles right now. And I think if you gave the public the option and you had facilities or somehow got it going, I think the problem would solve itself. I don't think educated people know the difference. And I'm getting $3.45 a pound for my bird. So we're talking 7-pound birds sometimes. It's a big investment, but I have no problem selling out. So, you know, I think the local thing is more than just a trend. I think people are like this show is pointing out and stuff like that. But, to me, it's a matter of, you know, letting me accomplish what I want, and then more of us will come along.
All right. Thank you, Scott. And Christopher, one thing I want to ask you is about challengers to Tyson. You have small guys, small outfits like Scott, who aren't really going to be a threat to Tyson. Are there challenges to this sort of method of producing meat?
Scott brings up this critical point. I mean, what he's talking about is a huge problem. I hear it all the time. The big meat packers and the American Meat Institute, they're well-funded lobbyists here in Washington. They always want to talk about, oh my goodness, the meat industry is so heavily regulated, and that's true. I mean, there are USDA food safety inspectors at every major mega Tyson Foods plant in the country and plants for the other companies. But these regulations are written in a way that go hand in glove with the interest of the big meat packers. And Scott is pointing to a perfect example of this. The way the USDA food safety regulations are structured now, it acts as a barrier to competition. the fact that you need to slaughter at a large concentrated mega plant to make it work, and you know, someone like Scott is having to ship his birds 40 miles to get a, you know, approved inspection, that keeps out competitors. And that's just one element of a lot of factors that right now create an incredibly high barrier to competition. And, you know, chapter 12 of the book, I talk about the economic crisis of 2008, which created a real moment of opportunity that entrepreneurs could have jumped in. And I'm not talking about small producers. I'm talking about big producers, maybe someone who'd want to invest $25, $50 million to build a poultry plant. But even in that moment, the big players were able to edge out and squeeze out and suffocate new competitors and make sure that nobody could get into the business. So I think it's a market today where there's entrepreneurial spirit and interest, but a very, very high barrier to entry.
Now, in our last minute here, Christopher, when he got into office, President Obama launched an attempt to reform the meat industry in about 2010. He brought on Tom Vilsack to take on the concentration of power that you're talking about in the agricultural industry, that the meat industry in particular. Could you talk about why that failed?
Yes, I can. I mean, they proposed a very sweeping set of antitrust reforms. Would have been the most sweeping since the Great Depression. Basically, what happened is what has happened several times in the past. The meat industry lobbyists in Washington, very, very, very well-funded group that has a lot of money to pass around Congress, this group kicked into action and just started killing these reforms by death with a thousand cuts. I won't get into it in detail. It's all in the book. But essentially, in just 1 year, they turned the tide on this, and the Obama administration began to retreat on its own efforts to pass antitrust laws, while at the same time, the meat industry's allies in Congress started to fight it and defund certain measures, and ultimately, the effort collapsed. But I think that there's a critical element that was missing. Addressing these problems is not rocket science. There's a great book out right now called The Bully Pulpit by Doris Kearns Goodwin. It recounts the presidency of Teddy Roosevelt, and the situation he faced back then was very similar to what we have now, giant corporations stifling economic growth, and they passed reforms to bust up the trusts. You just need willpower to do it.
Christopher, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for the time.
Christopher Leonard is a fellow with the New America Foundation and former national agribusiness reporter for the Associated Press. His new book is called The Meat Racket, The Secret Takeover of America's Food Business.